Welcome to the Immigrant Entrepreneurs Show, where our mission is to inspire, influence, and impact other immigrant entrepreneurs to follow their dreams and create the future they want and desire. My guest today is Katarina Polanska. Katarina, welcome to the show and glad to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Awesome. Katarina, first of all, where are you?
I'm in Spain right now. Nice. Where I have recently emigrated to.
Oh, wow. So you live in Spain?
I live in Spain, yeah.
That's amazing, because usually people go to Spain for vacation.
Nope. I decided to move here. And now, as I'm going through the visa process with my husband, I'm wondering why we've decided to move here. But we live here now.
That's wonderful. Okay, So tell us about your name. I would say it doesn't sound very Spanish.
No.
Tell us what's the backstory. Where were you born, and all the way, maybe a short view to how you got where you are.
Short view. I mean, I've been in many countries. I'll try and keep it short. So I think the name is actually a Polish name, but I'm not Polish. I had a friend break it down to me. She said it means that I'm of Poland, Polonski. Anyway. Or Polonska, but I am by blood, I'm half Slovakian, half Russian. I was born in Slovakia, just as communism was collapsing. And funnily enough, I actually obviously don't remember anything of that. I was a baby, but quite recently, as I've been doing kind of more therapy and working on some inner blocks that I've had as an entrepreneur, working with, you know, what it takes to scale and grow a business, I've realized I think there actually was quite a lot of stuff that I absorbed kind of in that transition from Eastern, you know, kind of Russian economy or communist economy, whatever it was, to more of a capitalist model, and experience what my family went through with that. So I was born in Slovakia. My brother was born in Russia, and just before I was born, the whole family actually left Russia, moved to Slovakia. That's where I was born. And then we moved to England when I was about 4 years old. Moved with my dad. He got a job offer in England with I think it was a university or some kind of like educational institution up north in England. And then we actually left the northern England. We didn't have a great experience there being Eastern European immigrants. Mm. It wasn't the most welcoming place for us in the early 90s. Mm. And so we made our way down south. And yeah, I pretty much grew up in the UK. So I grew up in England. But when I was about 19, that bug for traveling hit me again, which I think will always be in me. And I think that is partly symptomatic of being an immigrant, right? You probably hear that all the time.
Absolutely.
Because at 19, I decided to take a year to study in Italy. So I was studying in the UK, but I took a year out, like Erasmus. It's a very common program. Did a year in Italy. Loved that, living in Venice. Came back to the UK. I think I did another like 2 years in the UK. And then when I graduated, I was like, I think I did a year in London. And then I decided time to go again. So I moved to Spain. And then I did a bit of time in Spain. Then I left Spain. Then I went back to the UK. And then I was like, time to go again. So I went to Dubai. Lived in Dubai for a while, for I think 2.5 years. And then I left Dubai, came back to the UK, told myself, I'm not leaving. I'm staying. And then I went to Canada on holiday to visit my friend from Dubai, fell in love with Canada, fell in love with British Columbia, I should say. Mm-hmm. And I remember of things like day two of visiting British Columbia, that I actually said to the hotel receptionist, I'm going to move here. This is going to be my new home. So I had an amazing 2 weeks there. And then when I came back, I started looking to the visa and the like immigration process. I knew that Canada was actually quite welcoming to immigrants. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I applied. And I think within 10 months, I got a visa to go over there. So I moved and ended up staying there 5 years, which is the longest I've actually ever lived in any kind of country outside of the UK. So I did 5 years there. I did all my COVID experience there, and then came back last year, largely because, I mean, my dad lives in Ukraine now. Mm-hmm. So when the war kicked off, I was like, oh, I don't want to be so far from home. It's just too painful. And for personal reasons, I just wanted to kind of get a new start. So I left Canada, came back to the UK. I said I wouldn't leave. I said I wouldn't leave. So I'd stay. And then I think I lasted about 9 months in the UK before I was like, I don't think I can stay here. I think I need to leave. And so I met my husband and we looked at like, where shall we live together? Because he was from Canada. He was from Canada. Mm-hmm. I was from the UK. We didn't have a common visa in together. So he wanted to go to Colombia, which I wasn't so sure about. So I didn't know if I want to go so far away again. And I didn't want to go back to Canada. It felt too recent. Plus, it's just expensive. I'd moved everything from Canada to England. It didn't make any sense. He didn't want to go to Canada. So we basically landed on here, Ibiza, Spain. Wow. And now we are going through the visa process for him. So I don't know how long we'll be here. The future's kind of very, we don't know where we're going to end up.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's amazing. Thanks for sharing. And I can resonate with a lot of what you just shared, you know, having lived in so many different places. So a couple of questions. Number one, are you going to through the visa process because he's not from Europe?
Yes.
For him?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Then number two, Ibiza. I have been to Ibiza a couple of times, mostly to go and have fun during summer. Yeah. I don't, and I have a few friends that have houses in Ibiza. One of them actually lives in Ibiza because they're remodeling their house in Switzerland. And my question is, what does Ibiza feel like in winter or off season?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. It's funny, anyone who lives in Ibiza prefers the winter because I was actually thinking about it yesterday, like the weather's pretty stable. You know, it's not warm, but it's not freezing cold. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really rain much, maybe like a few days a month, but it's pretty stable. It's still sunny. It's empty. It's so quiet. The beaches are empty and the winter restaurants are open still. So you can get like the best food. Mm-hmm. You can, and everyone on the island, the reason I came back here when I was kind of thinking about like, okay, well, where do I go now? And, you know, there's a war going on and it's kind of like going personal thinking of if I was going to live my best life, where would I live it? And don't get me wrong, I loved Canada. I absolutely loved living in Vancouver. But it's just far away. Mm-hmm. It just felt very far. But when I thought about it, I was like, I love what Ibiza has to offer because the community here are generally quite close. Everyone here is in many, well, not everyone, but a lot of people here are immigrant entrepreneurs.
Right.
And then, you know, immigrant kind of in a loose sense, like maybe they're from England or maybe, but generally speaking, most people have gone through some kind of a struggle with a visa to get here. And most people are self-employed because it's, you know, the island is small. And in the winter, what are you going to do for work here? Mm-hmm. Right. So most people are actually building businesses or they're working remotely. So there's kind of very entrepreneurial energy to the island, which, for me, I resonate with it. It's kind of like free-spirited. We've left our homes. We've left our family. We're all trying to build something new here. And it's not a cheap island. It's not, you know, the easiest island to live in. Mm-hmm. But everyone's here with a purpose. And I really like that. Like, I generally like kind of immigrant communities wherever I've lived because everyone's there with a purpose.
Mm-hmm. I love that because when you said I live in Ibiza, I was like, Ibiza is an amazing place to live. But one thing that I always want for myself, and it's number, let's say it's number one, is it family friendly? Number two, that the criteria that comes right after being family friendly when I want to move to a place is, okay, what is the entrepreneurial vibe like? You know? And when you said I live in Ibiza, I was like, okay, Ibiza is empty. You're on your own. If you do anything, if you connect with someone, then it's all online. But I'm surprised that you say there are lots of entrepreneurs that are actually in Ibiza.
100%. Like it's kind of amazing how many people are kind of hidden in here. There's a couple of co-working spaces, which have, again, really interesting people. There's like a TEDx event that happens here. And I mean, it's not London. It's not like a big city. But I think one thing I realized is that for me to be successful in my business, I'm going to have to be online. And I say that with intention because I want to remain free. Like Who knows? Maybe in a year we decide to move again. Maybe we decide to stay forever. I don't know. But I like that freedom. But I also love having that local community of people who, you know, kind of are in a similar mindset. So most people are working online if they're entrepreneurs, but they also connect together.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay. So for all the listeners and viewers from North America that don't know maybe where Ibiza is. Ibiza is an island that is world famous, actually. But it's an island in Spain that usually people used to go to party, but now also has become a very nice, I would say, and prime destination for people that like to live there. And it's also very luxurious in a way, right?
Yeah. No, it is. Yeah.
It's not cheap, cool.
But it's beautiful.
Let's dive into your story and how you got into what you do today and how you got into entrepreneurship. So tell us more about that. Did you just wake up one day and you were like, okay, I'm going to start my own business, or what was it like?
No, it was, and again, you probably hear this a lot. So my father, who is now entrepreneurial, but he wasn't entrepreneurial like growing up, again, kind of grew up in Soviet Russia, but he always said to me from such a young age, you never want to work for anyone else. You only want to work for yourself. Like drummed that into me. And I think I was 17 when I actually did my first ever coaching certification, mainly for my own kind of self-growth and self-development. And my father paid for it. And after that, I was like, right, I'm going to build a coaching business. And I was 17 and I didn't even want to go to university because I was like, I'm confident that I can do this, which is ridiculous now. But anyway, and I did go to university, and it was at university that I actually started my own little, I found it the other day, my own little like website, my little business cards. And I was coaching students on how to succeed academically because that's something I knew how to do. I was very good. Again, kind of classic immigrant. I was very good at academic success and performing and, you know, high achieving and doing everything right. So I was teaching that. And eventually I realized, well, if I want to do well academically, I can't keep running this little business. So I stopped it. And then when I left university, I did 1 year of working for a very entrepreneurial wine company. And that wine company wasn't, I never thought I'd work in wine. It was purely, there was a recession going on and I was reading career books, you know, trying to figure out what do I want to do. I actually wanted to be a journalist working in, you know, international countries, like as a kind of war correspondent or something, you know, something very dangerous. That's what I wanted to do. And when it was a recession, I remember thinking, well, I'm never going to make any income doing that. And it's incredibly unsafe. And I'm probably going to be incredibly unhappy. And so it was really a very practical decision when I looked at like kind of the economy. I remember thinking like, what business, what industry is doing well when there's a recession? And it was like, well, wine, the wine industry is typically doing quite well because people are always drinking.
Always. So, always drinking. If it goes up, if it goes down, if it goes left, if it goes right, people will always drink.
Exactly. And I mean, I personally really loved wine. After living in Italy, in Venice, when I discovered like Prosecco and I did some wine tasting and I did the Chianti region. So I thought, what a lovely thing to do to ride out this recession. I was very naive. I thought recessions are like 1 year, you know, and I'll just get a hobby for a year. And so I trained. I did my like my wine WSET exams for an internship. They paid me to do them, and then I worked for a very small entrepreneurial boutique champagne and wine company, which I was only there for a year and a bit. But I will say it was probably one of the best kind of careers of my life because I'd never done sales, I'd never worked in an entrepreneurial kind of boutique environment, I'd never like hustled, and I say that with quotation marks. I'd come from like an academic little background where I don't know, I was like, I don't do sales. Like, I got a first class degree from a good university. I don't do this. And I remember when I joined that company, I had to create a role for myself there. Like they created a role for me and they basically gave me some champagne and said, well, go and sell it. And I was like, what do you mean? And I was in the middle of London, it was winter. They were like, go and sell it. And I remember knocking on doors of like galleries in central London, them opening the door, and I would get like brain freeze, my mouth would freeze. So I'd be so scared of saying anything. I had such fear. And it was like a hard year, but it was a year where I actually learned how to kind of do sales. And there was no training. It was just kind of like get out there and sell. And that's really, I think, what got that bug in me of, you know, I want to be an entrepreneur. And I was very lucky that my my colleague at the time, he was very entrepreneurial as well. And so, yeah, I just learned a lot from these entrepreneurial kind of people. It was so much fun as well. Mm-hmm. Like the energy was just so much fun. So I left that organization to actually build my own champagne and wine company here in Spain.
Oh,
that
wow.
came from going on holiday and being like, everyone's paying a lot more here than they were paying in London.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the markup's a lot higher. So probably if I'm selling here, I can make money and, you know, let's try doing that. So I tried doing that. And the company's actually still semi-going now, like nearly 10 years later. I ended up leaving and selling my half to my co-founder, and he kept it going for a long time. So that was pretty cool. But nice. After that, I went to Dubai and I was like, I need to work in a bigger company. I need to work in something kind of a bit more stable and actually learn properly. Because that was really just like me trying to figure out, you know, how to build a business.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, 10 years later, I didn't plan to be an entrepreneur right now. Like, that's the disclaimer. I honestly didn't plan to be an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. Even today, I was actually on the phone to my other entrepreneur friend, another immigrant entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying to him, I was like, you know, I really miss my corporate life. I really miss that lovely paycheck. I miss the stability. I miss that safety. Because over the past 10 years, I was really lucky that in Canada, I just kind of found my career. Like in Canada, I got into a really good company with excellent pay, amazing people. And I was selling diversity, equity, and inclusion. So it was like a really kind of great thing to be doing. And I didn't want to leave it. I only left it because of Ukraine war, really. I only left it to come back to Europe. And when I came back to Europe and I worked for another corporation, I just couldn't do it. I didn't like them. I didn't like the energy. I didn't like the team. I didn't like the product that much. And at that point, I was like, well, I can't do this. So I can go work for another company, but I'm tired and I'm burnt out.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what I'm going to do. Again, this kind of like war was in the back of my mind, you know, like it changed my thinking quite a lot. And so my plan originally was to take a sabbatical. It was to take a career break, take 3 months off, 6 months off, maybe go to Spain on holiday and just see what I want to do, what I want to do with my life, what company I want to work for. And then I met my husband. And so that plan kind of went out the window because at that point we had a bigger problem to solve. And the problem was, well, where are we going to live if we decide to stay together? Right? Like we can go back to Canada, but neither of us wanted to do that. And he can't live in England. He can't, you know, I can't just move to Colombia. So at that point, I think we both began to realize if we actually want to be together and not have to go to Canada, we probably have to be self-employed. And that it really was like a kind of a product of necessity of, okay, well, if I'm going to be self-employed, what is it that I want to create? What do I actually want to do? And it's taken me probably a year to get clarity to where I've got to now of like experimenting and putting myself out there reluctantly half the time. There was a lot of like, oh, I'm not ready to do this. And this is a lot of work and I'm scared of doing this and what are people going to think and what are my old corporate colleagues going to think and everyone's going to think that I've lost my mind and yeah. So, but now I'm here and I'm looking onto 2024 and I've got a plan. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling clear. I love my clients. Like I love the work that I do and I'm happy that I got here by accident. If that makes sense. It wasn't really accident. But I'm happy that I got here by necessity.
And you are open, kind of open to receive it, you know, because if you're close-minded and not open, then you might pass all opportunities and all projects all, you know, and but you don't do anything about it. But you're when you're open to receive and something comes your way, then you're like, oh, okay, let's take a look at that.
Yeah, what no, you are right. You are right. And I honestly think that it was... two things happened in Canada. One, I was previously engaged and I called off my engagement. And that was hands down the hardest thing I've ever gone through in my life, which is funny because I didn't think I'd say that. You know, I watched my parents go through a divorce 10 years ago and I had anorexia as a teenager. Like I've had hard things. But that was like the hardest and most humbling thing to go through because everything that I'd built up as this kind of, you know, A star person, high achiever, crumbled. Mm-hmm. And the humility, the shame, the kind of the pain of that, and having to call off a wedding and all of that was so much. And it was a big part of why I actually left Canada. It was very much like I just need a fresh start. So that was humbling. And then put the Ukraine war on top of that and kind of worrying, like, is my father going to make it out alive? Like, what about his family? What about, you know, my family are in Slovakia, they're on the border and all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. It humbled me to the point of, I realized there's no point clinging to the things that give me a feeling of safety or stability just because they give me safety or stability. Like, that's not enough of a reason to cling to them. Mm-hmm. My corporate job and that corporate paycheck, yes, it's nice, but it's not enough of a reason to have it, right? Mm-hmm. And it was this kind of feeling of, like, if we are all, because at one point I really did think that there's going to be, you know, nuclear war and all of this awful stuff. I kept thinking, like, if this is going to happen, what do I actually want to be doing with my life? Mm-hmm. And it definitely wasn't going to be grinding away in a corporate office for 12 hours, hating everything I'm doing, right? Nor was it going to be earning a lot of money, but living alone in my apartment in London in the rain, unable to leave the house because I'm working 12 hours. It just kind of opened me up to think, okay, I have to think creative now. I have to be honest with myself. Mm-hmm. I have to be really, really honest. Like, what is it that I want to do? And it might be less money, and it might be navigating visas, and it might be, you know, here in Spain with, like, mold growing in our bedroom, which we're like, why is this here? Mm-hmm. But at least it's a choice, right? Mm-hmm. Like, at least it's kind of an unintentional choice,
right,
if that makes
right.
sense.
Absolutely. So first and foremost, thank you for being vulnerable and sharing all of the things that you experienced. I do believe that it takes a lot of self-confidence to show up and share all about the things that, you know, you experienced, but also the pains and the maybe the darkness that you experienced. Mm. I also believe, and I would love to hear your take on that. I also believe that in order to experience greatness, we have to experience lows. We have to go and face the truth. We have to go and unpack whatever it is that we don't want to look at order to, you know, remove that junk and then go and experience that high that comes after it. But it only happens if we are willing and if we are honest, as you said, to ourselves, to unpack that junk and remove it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
you speak my language, 100%, 100%. And I think something I was talking to someone yesterday, something that really kind of humbled me in that experience was, I think I spent a lot of my 20s and even, you know, kind of my early 30s thinking, but I'm being vulnerable, I'm being honest, I'm doing everything. And again, it was only when everything in my life imploded and it just came crashing down and everything that I thought I knew, I didn't know anymore, from kind of my personal relationship to, like, my family to everything, and everything collapsed. That's when I was actually able to take a really honest look. And I realized, yeah, I wasn't being honest with myself.
Mm.
I was being as honest as I was able to hear. Mm-hmm. And the vulnerability that I was presenting to anyone was like a very manicured vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
It was still an image that I was controlling. And it was only when I lost control completely and didn't know what the heck to do and was so full of fear that the real vulnerability came out and the real honesty came out. And I think that's something I struggle to convey to some people, because something I hear a lot of with successful professionals who come to me, you know, they're considering maybe work with me, is it's kind of like, yeah, I don't need to look at my past. I don't need to, I'm already being honest with myself.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's fine. Like, I just want to, you know, find a partner. I just want to do X, Y, and Z. And that's when I'm like, but it can't be the case, because there's clearly something that's out of integrity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's clearly something that needs clearing. We all have stuff that we need to clear. We all have stuff that we're probably still hiding from ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's just part of being human, because it's scary. It's scary.
Absolutely. And yeah. I do believe those people that say, and I'm one of them, or I was one of them, you know, I was like, no, life is good. I've got everything under control.
Yeah.
I just need to do this. And then everything is perfect, which of course it was not and still is not, right?
Yeah.
I do believe those people that, and again, ask me how I know, that say, hey, no, I don't need to look at this, because the reason being is that they exactly know it's going to be painful and they want to avoid the pain, because they exactly know how painful it's going to be.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So my I love this conversation already. So my question for you, when people come to you, and you obviously you work with a lot of high achievers and executives, successful people, however we define success. Yeah. So what is it that, you know, how do you get them with those that end up working with you, or you end up working with them? It's not only a one-way street, right?
Yeah.
I believe you can choose your client. So how do you get them from being completely guarded to becoming off-guarded and opening up and being also open to look at whatever is hidden in their life?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And I think it's still something I'm figuring out, because I can see how with certain people, it does take a while. I think that the main thing, and one of my clients said it so beautifully yesterday, he said, you know, because he had this kind of idea, which I think most high achievers, high performers, whatever, I had the same thing myself have thought, which is, I can figure it out myself. I'm smart enough. I'm accomplished enough. I know how to get things done. I don't need someone to tell me what to do. I can figure it out. I can Google it. I can read a book. I can do a podcast, whatever it is. And then I'm good. And I did that for most of my life, like 100%, right? I always feel like, why would I pay a stupid amount of money if I can figure it out myself? Like, why? And it's not true, ultimately. At the end of the day, there are going to be experts for pretty much everything out there. And it really comes down to kind of what level of expertise can you afford, right? So like, to work with someone like Esther Perel, who's one of my favorite relationship coaches, I dread to think how much it is to work with her. I absolutely dread to think. But it really comes down to what my client said to me yesterday, which is, you know, I asked him like, what got you to want to work with me? And he said, it was in talking to me and kind of learning about the program and learning about the journey that he is going through or would have gone through kind of the program and working with me, and how much of that was unknown to him, how much of that was like a surprise and like, actually I haven't thought about that, or I didn't even know this thing was an issue. And so having these kind of like knowledge gaps being revealed, I think can be humbling. And he said it so well. He said, you know, it's kind of hard to stomach being a failure in one area of my life. He's not a failure, but in his own words, like a failure in one area of my life when I'm so successful in every other area of my life. Like, it's not something I want to admit. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I mean, if you want to change, then like with anything, you have to get the knowledge, right? And so when you know that there are knowledge gaps, that's when you have to do the work. You have to lean in. You have to be vulnerable. And ultimately, you will get what you put in. And it's not about effort, but it's about honesty. Mm-hmm. I think it's much more about honesty than about just effort, right?
That is so true. And you know, one thing that I also experienced myself is, you know, in Switzerland, I was good. We had a good life and everything. And I was like, okay, let's level up. Level up is going somewhere I have never lived, which is, in this case, we came to the US. Mm-hmm. And it was so humbling for me. Mm-hmm. When we came to the US, I realized, hey, you're a nobody. You're an absolute freaking nobody that no one, I said that once, actually, a friend of mine was in the room. He said, no, that's not true. I said, absolutely no one cares about you. He said, no, that's not true. I care about you. That's very kind of him.
Yeah.
But you know, when I came here, obviously we didn't know anyone. We had almost no one. We knew one single person. And then we had zero relationships. So we realized, hey, everything that we would do back home in Switzerland and would, you know, take us one call, one message, one whatsoever,
Yeah.
Here, you have to go through the grind. You have to go and do everything that you have never done before. So it was very humbling. At the same time, I always wanted to prove to myself, hey, did I just get lucky in Switzerland and, you know, became successful and built, did the things that... No, I didn't. If it was not just luck, so let me go somewhere else and go somewhere I don't know anyone, I have never lived there, and do it again, you know?
Yeah.
So when you say these people are willing to unpack, I do believe that that there is absolutely... It takes a lot of self-awareness to go there and look at the things that you want to look at. So we don't have much time left. I want to, I respect your time. You told me you have to. So I believe we have another 10 minutes.
10, 15 minutes.
Okay, cool. So tell us how you, you know, what was the starting point? Okay, now you decided to do what you're doing today. And how did you get started? How did you... How did you also felt like, okay, this is something I feel excited about doing for the, I don't know how many years in the future? Tell us more about that.
Who knows? So I was lucky that I come from the behavioral science world. So after I left the champagne industry, the wine and champagne industry, I went into philanthropy. So after living in Dubai, I became very passionate about human rights and equality. So I studied that. Well, I studied like gender, and then I went to work in philanthropy, trying to help Syrian refugees. That was one of the big things. That's actually why I moved to Canada. There's a lot of philanthropic money there. And then slowly I kind of moved into behavioral science, like understanding, you know, how do you persuade people and how do you, because really my initial hypothesis was I want to learn how to persuade people to do more philanthropic work. And when I started working in behavioral science, I mean, I worked for a corporation in behavioral science. So really what I was learning is how to make people more productive and happy at work. So not quite what I wanted to learn, but it was still interesting. And what I learned there was that group learning is super helpful, like group training, but really you want to have a kind of that coaching element infused in it. And that's how I discovered coaching and kind of came back full circle to what I did when I was 17. And then I worked for a big coaching company in London when I moved back. And whilst I didn't love working at the company, I did love the coaching. And so one of the things I always said was, it will never hurt to gain a qualification. Like it never hurts to study, right? Again, kind of immigrant mentality. So I invested into getting my ICF, the International Coaching Federation qualification, pay for the training. I think I paid a bit more than I should have because I went to a really good school, which in retrospect, I don't think I needed a really good school, but I got some good training. And as I was doing the training, they say, you know, to pass the exam, you have to get coaching hours, you have to actually accrue coaching hours. So suddenly I had this pressure of now I have to go out there and coach people, and it can't be for free. Like you can do some free, but there has to be some kind of an exchange. And so that's when I think I just was like, okay, well, I guess I'm gonna charge a small amount and start coaching people in my network professionally. And so I started, and after the first few coaching sessions, I was like, okay, this is enjoyable. I think someone cried on session three with me, and I was like, oh, okay. Like we went deep. They found it useful. And then I kept going, and then the necessity really kicked in. Cause then at that point I was like, well, you know, at this point, I think we were traveling. We were in Slovakia. My husband and myself, we were in Slovakia. We were actually doing fertility treatments. We were trying to freeze my eggs, throw that into the mix. So we're in Slovakia. And there's no cash flow. There was like no income for both of us. He'd obviously quit his high school teaching job in Canada. And so he wasn't earning. I wasn't really earning. And at that point, I was like, well, we need to make some money because this fertility stuff's expensive. So what are we going to do? I guess I'm going to start coaching properly. And I just, I was very lucky that I had one mentor who was very helpful. He started connecting me to a few organizations, to charities. And so then I did the deal, went into the charity, started coaching the people there, and then just very slowly kind of started to build out a website, started to build up more of a press, very different to what it is now. It's just so funny how in a year, how quickly everything can change, or a year and a half. And and just started. And it sounds kind of like a slow and steady journey. It wasn't. It was filled with panic, anxiety. Like, what am I doing? What am I doing? A lot of LinkedIn, a lot of testing, a lot of just really putting myself out there and being so deeply uncomfortable, but you know, eventually getting more and more comfortable, and then some recommendations coming in and some referrals, and I'm still, you know, at the very baby stages of where I want to be. Because I do think this is something I want to do for, at least like 5 years. I'm not going to say more than that, because I don't really believe in having more than a 5-year plan, because so much can change, right? But I'm really enjoying, and I love the impact. So we'll see.
That's amazing. So tell us about, I know, you know, from doing my research, I know what you do, but tell us, please, what you exactly do and who you help and how you help them.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe before I even do that, I'll kind of give a kind of context of why this. Mm-hmm. And there's like a number of things kind of on a personal level. Well, no, I'll start with the professional level. Professionally, I started out coaching people with things like burnout, stress, anxiety, and kind of all of these issues. And what I found as I coached, you know, professionals in this area was that the burnout, stress, anxiety are symptoms of an underlying, what I concluded to be loneliness, like a kind of a disconnect. I actually started calling myself a connection coach a while ago, but I'm now just a relationship coach, much clearer. But this kind of disconnect between themselves and with others, because they're high achievers, because they're so successful, because their careers are so great. And, you know, like the guy I got on the phone today, they're working from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. It's normal. And so what I realized very quickly was that this kind of very high achieving, ultra intelligent, rational, go-getting, extremely accomplished mindset is fantastic for most areas of life, for your investments, for your home, for moving countries, for even making friends. But when it comes to the love life and the connection to the self, which is really another form of love life, right? Your love for yourself, it wasn't so great. And that kind of makes sense. If we think about, you know, we live in a capitalist economy where we're rewarded for producing, for doing, for kind of outputs. It doesn't make sense that we'd get rewarded for loving ourselves or having wonderful marriages or wonderful partnerships, right? Like, society doesn't really value that much. It's kind of in the back burner. And so it is neglected. And that's really what got me curious, because then it made me think, well, you know, I was working with my own coach, and she said, well, look, your own personal life story has been one of looking at failed relationships. Your parents got divorced because their careers were too ambitious and too powerful, and in the end, long distance got to the, you know, ruined it. You also called off an engagement. So, I mean, that is a failed relationship. You've been studying relationships when you looked at gender dynamics, which is what I did at university. And you've been doing marriage counseling, you've been doing all of the reading, you've been doing all of the work. So she's like, you're a relationship coach, you're not a business coach. And that was like a, oh God, really? Moment for me, because I could hear my parents' voices in the back of my head being like, what's she doing? But I kind of honed down on my training, on my studying. I consolidated everything that I knew. I actually did the math on how much money have I spent on my own relationship coaching, on my own training, on my own development, and was like, well, I spent well over $100,000 in this field. So I fair to say that there's a lot of knowledge going into here, but I kept consolidating it. And eventually with a psychologist, I started to build out a relationship program that ultimately encapsulates everything that I have learned over the past 15 years. And plugged it into a very kind of systematic methodology. Because again, I like structure, I like methodology, I like to achieve and move through a system. And so I built that out, and then I began testing it. So I tested it on a number of Oxford PhDs, people in my network, and got incredible results and feedback. And that's what really gave me the confidence of like, okay, I'm going to rebrand. I'm going to put relationship coach on my LinkedIn, and I'm going to go out there and see what happens. And yeah, I'm still doing it today. I've got a ton of clients that have taken through that program. And this year, my goal, well, not my goal, I'm doing it, is to do group coaching. So my one-on-ones are getting full. I don't really have capacity to take on more one-on-one. And rather, I want to do group coaching so that I can create more of a community for people who are like-minded professionals who can go through the program at their own pace. They're not going to go through together. It's at their own pace, but there'll be group calls, group community, maybe even a group retreat here in Spain. The idea being that I see the loneliness that a lot of these high achievers have, right? And the kind of this anxiety and fear that they're alone and that they're just, it's lonely at the top is what I hear a lot of. Or that there's something wrong with them, there's something different. And I've seen it now with, you know, over 100 people that I'm like, no, you're all thinking the same thing. I thought the same thing. So maybe we can all go through this journey together and kind of support each other through it. And who knows what connections might form as well, right? I've noticed there's a lot of coaching programs for women. There's not much out there for men. And so most of my clients are actually men, which is interesting. And so I deliberately want to have, you know, co-ed so that men and women can be together. And there's that kind of, yeah, that inclusivity and we can all learn and help each other. So that's my mission for 2024 is to really launch that and keep growing it.
That's amazing. And, you know, I can so much relate to that, talking also to other entrepreneurs in general, that it is a lonely journey. And I also believe that that community is going to be more and more important as we move towards the future. You know, that's another reason why, you know, behind this podcast and everything, we're actually building a community for immigrant entrepreneurs. So I'm going to invite you to it. You know, we're keeping doors a little tight for now because I actually made a post in the group and I said I'm going to protect this group like my own four walls. And this is what I'm doing because I want to make sure the right people get there. And eventually we open doors a little wider. So that's one thing. And another thing is, you know, when I was listening to you, you said, you know, I started that and then I was shifting. When we get into entrepreneurship, we don't always know what it's going to come out of it. You know, we have to stay flexible and be open to what comes and what the need is out there. And then be also flexible to adjust it and move along as we get the feedback from our customers. So with this being said, we'll definitely link you up in the show notes. I believe LinkedIn is also where you're most active. Is that fair to say?
Okay. Yeah.
So we'll definitely link you up in the show notes. People can find you and reach out to you. I could just go on for another hour, seriously.
No, I know, so me too.
We will definitely have you back sometime in the future and continue the conversation. Katarina, thank you so, so much for being here. But also thank you for being vulnerable and just sharing your story and your amazing life story the way it is. So a really, really, really warm thank you from my heart to yours. Thank you for coming on and spending time with me on the show. And it was a pleasure having you on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. No, I really, really enjoyed it. I'd love to be back if you would have me and join the community. Absolutely.
Absolutely. We will definitely make that happen. So thank you so much and have a blessed day.
Awesome. Thank you.